Hey, everybody, I'm Paul Yeager. Welcome inside the MTOM podcast studios here at Iowa PBS, which is where we originate this. And early on in this podcast, if you've listened for any of the last few years, you know that we've done a lot of behind-the-scenes information. Well, I've been thinking about the focus of this podcast. And by the way, if you have any feedback for me or questions or guest ideas, paul.yeager is the email. Paul.yeager at iowapbs.org is the email to send me those comments at. I was describing it to our guest today, what this podcast mission is. Yes, behind the scenes, still, we talk about stories, things that you don't see anywhere else, what's coming up on the show, so you can be in our insider club. But what I also like to do is take one little thing that might be 10 seconds on the show, say it's in the market analysis segment of Market to Market, and expand upon that. Today, we're going to be talking a little bit about profit margins, packer margins, when it comes into the livestock sector. Our guest today is Dr. Azzedine Azam. And he says, if you can say this, you can say that. Now, Dr. Azam's been in the United States longer than I've been alive. And we're going to talk about that trip that he had from Morocco to Wisconsin to now the University of Nebraska. Those of you who are in Nebraska, you're very familiar with your work. But other people are soon going to learn more about what he's doing. And that is a study of the livestock industry with COVID-19 and since. He is looking at what has impacted that industry. He's getting money from the United States Department of Agriculture to do this study. So we're going to talk about the academic side of looking at this and what he tries to do as an academic and how he studies and how this maybe helps us better understand the economics of the meatpacking industry. That is our topic today on the MTOM Show podcast. Let's get going. All right, Doctor, this is the time of year when academics are, you're all over the place. I see you presenting. Do you prefer to do things? I want to look at data only, or are you one of those that likes to put the hard hat on, get in the gloves, get in the full garb and dive in and touch whatever it is you're researching?
Both, really. Let me put it in our jargon. I'm more of a deductive economist. There are inductive economists. I mean, the best analogy that I tell my students, the deductive economist will sit in their office and ask the question, if I were a horse, how would I behave? The inductive economist will actually go to the barn, touch the horse, and observe them, and then make inferences about how horses behave. So I tend to be... You know, the person that sits in their office and try to, you know, deduce a model about the behavior of a horse. But I will tell you also, I do not hesitate to go to the barn and actually touch the horse. And I talk to real people like you and try to be in touch with livestock marketing economists. So I try to come up with a weighted average because I know that neither method is really sufficient. You have to have the economic principles guiding your thinking, but at the same time, you don't want to assume that, you know, a steer has only one leg. I mean, that's not very realistic. So I'm both a deductive and an inductive type agriculture economist.
Yeah. And you're a guy who has dived into the United States. You came here as an exchange student to Wisconsin from your home in Morocco. And then you go back home and you decide, I want to come back to the United States. And you kind of been here ever since. What's your background there?
In Morocco or here?
Either way.
Yeah. Well, I did my French education type in high school in Morocco. And then at age 16, I was fortunate to get a scholarship from the American Field Service to come to the U.S. I think, if I remember correctly, what I was told, there was about 2,000 applicants in Morocco, and they picked about 12, and I was one of the lucky ones. And came to Delavan, Wisconsin, right by Lake Geneva, and went to high school and stayed with an American host family. Went to high school, did all the things you folks do in high school, went to prom and went all these things. It was such a wonderful experience, believe me. It gives you a positive attitude about this country, coming here young. And I went back and came back to the United States. And then I went to University of Wisconsin. I remember driving there and applying. And they gave me a scholarship on the same day because I had a U.S. high school diploma. So that was my union card.
So you go to Wisconsin and then graduate work after that? Where was it?
Yeah, the graduate work, master's was in Wisconsin, and then I came to the University of Nebraska in Lincoln to do a PhD. And I did a PhD in ag econ, and I worked with a wonderful professor and worked on livestock markets. And that's what I really picked, that piqued my interest. And as I said, in combination, my wife, who is from Sweden, she came to Nebraska too and did her PhD in animal science. And so she knew more about animals and I know more about economics. So she was my consultant when I didn't know what a club calf was or a heifer or a steer. And I was very fortunate. I came to, when I came to UNL, they gave me an assistantship. And I remember the first project I worked on was integrated pest management. I didn't even know what it was. And so they connected me with an entomologist, Ivan Berry. I remember it, you know, warm-heartedly. One of the most wonderful people gets me in a pickup and he says, let's go to a feedlot. And the project that I was working on was about stable flies, how they affected the cattle, you know. And so my job was to go sample stable flies and develop a mathematical model. At that time, the question was, should we clean the lot, you know, clean it up, or should we spray with pesticides? And so what's the economics of cleanup versus spraying? And that really hooked me on the cattle industry. It's just wonderful. Besides, in Morocco, watching a lot of cowboy movies and coming here and watching Rawhide. So it all...
It all came together and put together in one.
It is. It's a wonderful industry. I know. I mean, you say, well, you know, this guy doesn't have a lot of skin in it because he's not raising his own cattle and has to... I was told that, you know. But it's a phenomenon. It's fantastic. It has a wonderful history. When I went back and looked at the history of the industry back all the way to the 1600s, back to William Pynchon in Boston, the first person to start, you know, packing pork. And it's a long story, but anyway. So when you combine history with regulation and develop and technology, and you know, it's a case study that is just fantastic. And it gives you a sense of how it has evolved with the evolution of history in this country.
So. Well, and the reason I bring up my first question to your background to now is that as a researcher, you have to have, I would imagine, a little bit of everything to be taken credible. Because if you sit in, let's call academic the ivory tower, which it sometimes gets that way, it's like you never go get your boots dirty. But when you understand the mentality of a cattle producer with the hard data of what the economics are, if they do one thing over another, I would imagine the message sinks in a little bit more. Is that accurate?
It really does. It really does. And by the way, I've talked to producers. I went to Kearney and you know, I had lunch with them. And I really understand. I don't want to call it dilemma. I mean, it is a, what I'm beginning to see, I appreciate the independence that cattle feeders and ranchers want, but I also understand what I would call, I'm going to be careful here, the coercive aspects of markets. In a capitalistic free society like this, these things work out sometimes to the disadvantage of people that do not have alliances and don't have countervailing economic power. In some other countries, these things are resolved, like in Sweden. That I know because I'm going to spend the summer there working with them on some issues. In Sweden, they have cooperatives. They have But this is historic in Sweden, so they've always worked with cooperatives. Well, and those cooperatives countervailed what we call the market power of processors. I see differently in the United States, and this is, I think, at the end of the day, it's embedded in culture, and I'm not making any value judgment at all, is that, you know, to maintain this independence that people derive a lot of utility from, if they want to share in the pie, what I call the pie of the supply chain, get a bigger slice of the pie, the profits, you know, in the supply chain, one has to come up with some mechanisms, which leads me to the second point in my project, which is what USDA is trying to do by helping farmers expand capacity by building smaller new plants for competition.
Well, I want to go back to something you said just a moment ago about the, basically what you're saying is the number of packer options. You're not necessarily calling out one specific JBS over Tyson over whomever, but it is an industry that is very consolidated is a word. But it's no different if you look at when you go to the airport, how many different airline companies are there? When you go to buy soft drinks, how many different soft drink companies are? I mean, we have come to, we might start with 100 and we usually end up with about four or five. So in that sense, the beef and the meat industry is not different than many of the others in the United States.
It is. It is. What makes it different? By the way, theoretically, the principles apply to all industries. In a nutshell, industries are driven by demand and their cost structure. If it is cheaper to produce, you know, to slaughter a million head, but by the way, 12 plants in this country slaughter more than 1 million head. Their share is 51%. This consolidation is technology driven because you want efficiency. That's what it is. The difference, my hypothesis is, it really has to do with the final product. When certain products are essential, people are going to pay more attention to the industry. They really do. And you and I would agree that, you know, beef and pork and chicken in the food basket of the consumer, they are very, very important. And so is gasoline, you know. But a lot of us really don't think much about, you know, the prices of, I don't know, some other products that we don't deal with on a daily basis. Nobody complains about the price of salt, you know.
But if they see the headline that says salt went up 126% over a 2-year period, it gets their attention. It's math. Percentages are math. But it's not always that cost. Might have been what that tube of salt was $1.50, is now $3. We don't think too much of it, but when we go to buy a 2x4 and it was, we remember when it was $2 and now it's $8. We remember that.
Absolutely. And I would add one more dimension, and I don't want to go into lecturing about microeconomics or anything. And it also boils down to the share of that particular good in your total expenditure. I mean, salt is such a small portion. I mean, we don't line up in the grocery store to buy salt because it's on sale. But if hamburger goes down by 90%, I'm sure we will line up.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I think the essentiality of beef and pork and chicken and food products in general, it attracts attention. And the other thing is that really just understanding how supply chains work, you would be surprised, even among us academics who are deductive, or we don't invest a lot of time. Let me just talk for myself. A lot of time I learned through with age that you have to sit down and understand how markets actually work, rather than sit down and dream up how they work. And I read in the New York Times, Wall Street or New York, I don't remember, Times this morning, about gasoline prices. I thought a lot of these gas stations that say Shell right here in Virginia actually belong to Shell. They don't. A lot of us think that these gas companies are built, are owned by the refiners. There are 135,000 of them. I think, if I remember the numbers correctly, less than 8% are owned by refiners. So understanding, for example, where do refiners get gasoline, you know, from the United States and from world markets, all of a sudden, it's not as simple as I think. And the article was about how come there is this asymmetry in price movements, like when oil prices go up in the world market, you know, gasoline prices don't go up by as much, but when oil prices go down, gasoline prices go down, but they don't go down by as much either. There is this asymmetry. And you know, the explanations are really fantastic about how gas stations price their gasoline. They are much more reluctant to raise prices when oil prices are going up because they don't want to be the first ones to raise prices. But when oil prices go down, they don't want to be the first ones to lower the prices. So you get this asymmetry, and unless we understand the mechanics of how supply chains actually behave, we tend to have these ideas that have nothing to do with how the supply chain works.
Prior to March of 2020, I always had a fascination with supply chain, but now it feels like there's a whole lot more people that are paying attention to the supply chain. Do you find that that makes your work more important in wanting to do this study and understanding supply chains because there is all of us as consumers are more aware and cognizant of everything that happens to get the product from the field to our grocery bag?
I think in my own case, really, there are two aspects to this. One of them is that these products are very important in the welfare of consumers and cattle producers. Now we're talking about welfare. We're talking about actually the well-being of those who consume and the well-being of those who produce food. And please stop me if I go into what... Let me start with the Reagan era, okay? In the Reagan era, the school of thought was efficiencies and consumer welfare. That's what drives the discussion. So antitrust decisions about mergers and all that was about cost efficiencies and consumer welfare, what he would call the Chicago school type of thinking. Now with the Biden administration, there is a shift now. We're having what we call structuralist views of industries. That means that consumer welfare should not be the only criteria of judging the performance of industries. We should also look at those who, not just the people who consume the food, but also who produce the food. So you're gonna start being, concerned about cattle feeders, laborers that have to go and debone the meat. And when you look at the history of antitrust, this is what might surprise you, but you probably heard about it. Judges in antitrust cases a long time ago thought that it was good for the consumer that the price of farm goods were depressed. They didn't look at cattle prices being depressed as depressing the income of cattle feeders, let's say. They look at it as, yeah, that means that cattle is cheaper, so we will get cheaper. But that's not how it works, you know. And so that's one thing that motivates me, is that now we have a shift in the structuralist view. And so it's good to catch up with this and say, okay, I have been looking at it at Chicago school type, and I've done some of my work with John Schroeder at Iowa State University, where we look just at the trade-offs between market power and cost efficiency. Now, you know, we would like to, I would like to extend that to look at more issues in the industry. The other thing with the supply chain, and I would add, is resilience. That adds another dimension with COVID-19. Now, instead of just talking about trade-offs between market power and cost efficiency, we have trade-offs between market power, cost efficiency, and resilience.
Okay, say that again. We have just that last point that you said. Repeat that again. I want to hear that again.
Trade-offs between market power, cost efficiency, and resilience.
So when I look at these companies that are, you know, they make changes to their product, end product price, they've been able to say, well, it's because of COVID-19, and that's why we have to raise the price here. But then when you go and look at the quarterly earnings of these public companies, and all of a sudden their earnings are higher than they've ever been, oh, and it's because so there's a disconnect that people have that they get frustrated of, why do I have to pay more when they're still making more money? Shouldn't the company have some? Well, let's stick with the meat industry. I mean, you look at JBS's profits. I think I reported a couple of months ago that was their highest that they'd had, and you know, well over last year's profit. They're dealing with COVID-19, but yet that company and many of the others in the meat industry are still citing, well, we have all these COVID-19 things that we have done, therefore the price is still going to be up here and not back down here.
Yeah. It all goes back to what I said originally. At the end of the day, are those margins cost justified? And we really don't have enough information to be able to say whether they're price gouging. Mm-hmm. That is the dilemma for an economist. The other thing, I don't want to go into all these details. Economists look at profits differently from accountants. You may have a lot of cash in the drawer, but if you look at the economic costs rather than accounting costs, or economic profits rather than accounting profits, and economic profits are much harder to measure because you just can't go to an accounting book and pick them up. I'm hesitant to say that just because you have a lot of dollars in the drawer that somehow that you are not performing well as a company. So it comes down to measurement, and I'm not nitpicking here, you know, like, but we have to be very careful about how economists look at businesses versus how accountants look at businesses. Let's take a farmer who doesn't have a lot of market power or whatever. You may have a lot of cash in the drawer at the end of the year, but from an economic perspective, you're losing money because you're not accounting for the opportunity cost of your labor that goes into the family business. And so it's the same thing. They would say, how could you tell me that I'm losing money when I actually am making money? So, and this is not just an academic question. I mean, the way we learned economics is that you have to be very careful about how to account of what is cost and what is it. I mean, the opportunity cost, let's say, of labor is the wage that you observe in the market. But there is another opportunity. Like, for example, capacity. When capacity is idle, what's the opportunity cost of it? What interest rate do you use? So I hope I don't sound like I'm trying to, but we have to be very careful about measurement, and that's what I mean.
Well, and I understand, you know, we have to be careful when we look at it academically. I think of it as an investor, and I listen to my friends that when I talk about something, and they'll say, well, but the share price, that's all I care about is the share price. They don't, again, back to a, let's use a meatpacking term. They don't care how the sausage is made. They just want that sausage or the steak.
That's right. Well, they are able to protect their margins, and they are accountable to their shareholders. At the end of the day, the question is, are they gouging the market? Are they unjustifiably raising prices? are they unjustifiably passing prices? And at the end of the day, from an economic perspective, there is not really a lot of market power because people are sensitive to price. You know, in our everyday lingo, we say, you know, these packers or these airlines, they can charge anything. Well, in economics, we say, well, you know, demand is not perfectly inelastic. You know, in our jargon, there is some slope that means that if these companies are going to charge a high price, that, you know, consumers are going to respond by cutting down on the quantity that they consume, except that the degree to which that they cut down on the quantity consumed really depends on the product. And some products are more price sensitive than other products are less sensitive. And it works on the supply side, too.
Do you buy then the whole the cure for high prices is higher prices and the cure for low prices is low prices? Is that too simple of a boil down?
How does that work? What do you mean?
Well, there's an adage that we use quite often on market to market when we talk about, say, corn and soybeans. You know, as the price goes up or if the price is really low, they'll sometimes say that if the price gets too high, the demand will be cut and therefore will drop.
The response, yes.
And then conversely on the lower side
absolutely,
of things.
Absolutely. This is another thing. In self-equilibrating markets. And you notice, by the way, we with regards to inflation that's been highly discussed these days, do you notice that when you break it down, based on something I heard yesterday on PBS, is that the prices of goods have been dropping in March. You know, the bikes and the exercise equipment and refrigerators, when you look at the inflation figure, everything is going up. But once you start breaking them down, it goes back to show that consumers actually respond to higher prices and lower prices. Now that we have, you know, the pandemic seems to be, I hope, receding, the composition of demand for consumers has changed. So we're probably ordering less exercise bikes and we're going more. I've seen it here in Virginia. I mean, just anecdotally, on King Street here in Alexandria, people are out. You know,
they're not on their Pelotons. They're out on their own feet.
On their own feet, drinking and eating outside and things that are kind of crowded.
We've kind of talked all around your study here with USDA, but you're going to be funded by USDA to look at a couple of things. You've kind of talked about them at high levels. What do you hope? What's the reason for doing this research?
There are unintended consequences for every policy, okay? Theoretically, for example, let's take the concrete policy of expanding capacity among small producers in the packing industry. It is very intuitive, okay, that, if you want to enhance competition in the industry, you just add more packers, all right? Theoretically, entry in an industry, new entry, we call it de novo entry, is driven by profits. When the industry is profitable, you expect entry for people to take advantage of those profit opportunities. So if everything is going naturally according to markets, this is what you would expect. I want to qualify that by saying the de novo entry is very difficult sometimes in industries that are very highly consolidated because capital investments are so prohibited. Okay. Now, the entry that we are going to experience with USDA involvement it's not really a response to profit opportunities like in when markets are left alone. So we have a different type of entry. Is now the USDA is going to help subsidize or give grants to folks so they can either expand the plants that they have or build new plants. And I've heard in Iowa and some other places that people are actually building.
I know of a couple of in my own backyard where I grew up. They are openly asking because they say they've been able to expand their small town locker, yeah. And if they go from 5 animals to 10 animals a day, you know that's a nice expansion for them.
Nice expansion, and I would like to say also this is not an advertisement from my university, but UNL now has the University of Nebraska has an initiative where they're going to build a. They're going to have a program about small meat packing, and they're going to train labor. I applaud that. That is very good. The question is about the economics is, based on my reading, and I'm reviewing a lot of papers that are submitted about this subject, where they send some of them to me to look at. We have, there is a debate about this. You know, there are those that say it's a good idea, and there are those that say we really don't know for sure. And my contribution was a recent theoretical paper. It's very theoretical because we don't know. It hasn't happened yet. If markets works this way, under what conditions would we have resilience like the way USDA wants? And my results show, theoretical results, pending verification, other things that I would like to do in the future, that unless half of the cattle slaughter goes to smaller plants, it's just not going to work. So market share is very important. And the other thing is about how the small packers are going to behave in the market. And this is based on some arcane modeling economics. It's called dominant oligopoly and competitive fringe. So if you look at the small packers as the competitive fringe, the question is if cattle slaughter is allocated to them, you know, from the large ones to the small ones, what would you expect? Would you expect the industry to be more resilient? And my theoretical work is showing yes, but only under certain conditions. And then I conclude that those certain conditions would not hold unless you have active government involved.
Well, I certainly want to be able to hear how this turns out.
Yeah.
What you find. So I think we're gonna put a pin in your work right now. I don't want to hold you to everything that you have to do. You've got to do the research, right, and verify is what you're saying before we can.
And by the way, and hope my colleagues will respond to that research and do their own creative work.
That's the beauty of the academics, right? One inspires another.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. It's a joy to have folks like you who have. One foot in the real world also, you know, to be interested in what we do. I just hope I didn't go on lecturing and all that.
No, well, I guess I'm supposed to say we've gone enough time. We can say class dismissed.
Yeah, thank you very much. By the way, you have to give me a grade too.
Oh, I have to give the professor a grade. Oh boy. I will, anytime I get a chance to ask, and that's the joy of this job, Dr. Azam, is that when I host in this podcast, when I can talk to the economist, especially one in the academic field, and I can just ask him questions back and forth, and I don't have to write a paper, I'm showing my work right here, or take a quiz on it, I take that as an A. So very good. Thank you so very much for the time.
I really appreciate it.
My thanks to Dr. Azzedine Azam. Always good to meet a new person and learn a little bit more about what's going on in the research world and how it can better help all of us understand and maybe make sense of all the economies here that's happening. If you have any feedback for us here at the show, send an email, markettomarket@iowapbs.org. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll see you next time.